And we are live despite numerous technical difficulties today. This is one of those shows I came up with the idea for like Friday, and it's a Monday show. So I had all the time in the world to think about it and get it ready to go. So I'm like, I'll be right out of the gate, finish the morning routine, do a little bit of writing, and produce the show, pre-production anyway, and then go live, maybe instead of noon, 11, so I can get done early today. And here we are. 5 minutes after the 1 o'clock official start time Central Time, and just getting going. I won't bore you with all of it, but it involves things like we just had to move the entire Survival Podcast Network and Empire to a brand new server because our old server company that we have used since 2010 decided they don't want to be in the particular business of doing bare metal servers anymore. So we had to migrate that. That has created numerous issues that Tom is hammering down like whack-a-mole one at a time. Everything's moved. Everything works for you guys. It's my end that's the problem, i.e. right now, while a lot of other stuff has been solved, I still can't send an email. I can send it. It just doesn't get to the person I'm sending it to. It gets knocked back, and Tom's remedying that. And some other things that you guys really don't who my preferred host is doesn't matter, Tim. She is who's my preferred host now. I'm not going to tell you because we're not, we just migrated there. So they're not a preferred anything yet. They have to earn my business. They have to earn my loyalty. They have to earn my being willing to recommend them to others. But they seem to be good. I don't think the problems are theirs. I think it's like moving your email off of something that's been the same IP address since 2010, and it's 2026, and that's causing some issues with providers. But no, I'm not going to tell you who I'm using because they're not getting an endorsement yet because I've been using them for exactly 3 days now. So anyway, the whole point is I'm late for a reason instead of an excuse. There was a lot of stuff going on, but I am ready to do this show now. What we're going to talk about today is AI in a different viewpoint, right? We're going to talk about AI. We're going to look at it as a personal sovereignty tool, and we're going to compare it to the internet, and we're going to look at it from a standpoint of, what was the internet like, you know, about 1998? What was it really like? What was it like using it in your workplace? How had companies embraced it or not embraced it? What was it like 3-4 years before that? Like, we're gonna have to revisit a very famous moment that some of y'all are too young to remember or even have seen, but it was 1994 on national television when that was a big deal. Like, we didn't have 5 million channels yet. And all this stuff going on online and all these streaming services. Like, if you got something into one of the major networks, that was everywhere. Everybody saw it. It was Good Morning America talking about, what is internet? What is that app thing? What's that where do you hear this, right? And yet, 4 years later, the internet on some level is in just about every workplace in America that at least is an office environment, right? And even companies that were more like sending people out to do what I did, which was like, cabling work and dispatching, still the small team inside was using the internet, but yet there was a lot of hangups with it. And a lot of people were still saying things like, it's a fad and stuff like that. But then we'll talk about how it was adopted and how that adoption curve is now repeating itself and how 2026 with AI is kind of like 1998 with the internet. If that doesn't make sense, it will by the time we're done. We're also going to talk about how to get the most out of AI and use it to develop yourself, not just the things you're trying to get done. Instead of replacing tasks, how do we make the operator a better user? And I can hear it right now. There's people like, how is this a survival topic? Imagine it's 1995, 1996, 1997, and your view of the world is, I don't need the internet. And nobody tells you you're being a dumbass. How well would your career survived with that? How well did your career survive with that advice if you were around back then? If you are a young knowledge worker today, imagine being Gen X for a minute instead of a millennial or a Gen Z, right? And imagine it's 1995, you're a 20-something, and you ignore this shit for 10 years. You ignore the internet for 10 years. Where are you at? By 2005. If you don't think adapting to your environment is a survival skill, you don't even know what survival means. And as always, this show is the Survival Podcast. And as part of that, what it really is a lifestyle design architecture podcast. That just wouldn't hook very well. It wouldn't sell very well. I also liken it, as I did last week when we talked about AI. Same thing with Bitcoin. I told you Bitcoin. I got, is this the Bitcoin podcast? Okay. Don't do it. Have fun staying poor. And the people that listened during the adoption curve have done very well. And those who haven't, every word you use to resist it hurt only you. And that's reality. Permaculture, right? Totally different thing. Not technology based at all. Teach permaculture, how to grow your own food. There's people now that have their properties built to the point where they're producing some of their own food with their property in a very elegant way, in a very systematic way, a very natural, healthy way. And there's some people that are like, that's not a survival topic. I guess you don't need food. So is it a survival topic? You bet your ass it is, because unless you're ready to retire next week, you're going to have to deal with this, or you're going to have a hard time surviving the changes that are coming. With that in mind, before we get into today's topic, let's say hello to our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is JM Bullion. I mentioned Bitcoin during the intro. I am a Bitcoin bull. I believe that it is probably the best asset to sweep surplus capital in at this point in time in history, and it certainly was for the last 10 years. Well, I've been screaming that you should be doing it. But I've never stopped recommending precious metals as part of your wealth assurance program, as part of your lifestyle design. I recommend 5% of your net wealth be held in precious metals. And I mean physical metal you can put your hands on. I think that is the strongest case for it, is that you can do that with it. And up to about 10%. But why JM Bullion? Well, they support the show that you listen to, and they have done so for over 10 years. That's loyalty, so give them some back. They ship your orders for free. I can talk directly to the president. They give MSB members a discount. So why would you buy from anybody else, especially with the last bullet point? And that is, they sell their silver for a little bit less than Monex, Apmex, Lear Capital, and the other large silver houses out there. So check them out today. JM Bullion for all your silver, gold, and other precious metals needs. Next up today, we're going to talk about water. Berkey Water Filtration Systems. From Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason, which you can find at usaberkeyfilters.com. You got to check this out, because we need water. Without water, we're going to die. It's one of our primary survival needs, and one that we can do without for a relatively short amount of time. The official number is usually 3 days you can survive without water. It depends on the situation you're in. But day-to-day, it's part of your health, and you want the healthiest water possible. With the Berkey Water Filtration System, you will produce water at a price so low, it's almost free when you price it by the gallon, and you'll have the best quality water you can drink if something goes wrong with the water you're drinking or not. Check it out today at usaberkeyfilters.com. With that, I want to dig into this kind of deeply with you today on this kind of adoption curve, and changing your mindset as to how we even use technology and AI today versus this idea of it just being a thing to get things done. Like, I need to do a report. I'll put all the data in there. I'll let it compile it. It spits out a report. I'll dink on it a little bit, hand it to my supervisor, and yay, I'm a hero and I got it done. Or I'm going to turn this old picture into a movie, or I'm going to make a graphic that's funny, or you know, all the stuff that people are, it's like all parlor tricks, is what most people are doing with it. Even if they're doing something somewhat useful, it's not really maximizing the potential. Because you're not actually making yourself better with technology. Instead, you're using technology to replace yourself, all while saying, gee, I hope that I'm not replaced with technology, while you replace yourself with technology. Let me say that again. I want you to grasp that. How many people are doing this? They're using AI because they know they have to. You're using AI because you know people you're competing with are using AI. And you're doing it so that you can get your output quicker, and hopefully better than you could do without it, and hand that up the chain to wherever it goes. Or if you're at the top of the chain, making your final decision. But at the same time, companies, people, teams, positions, you know, like certain whole segments are shitting their pants. AI is going to replace me. So you're using AI to replace yourself, and you're worried that if you don't, AI will replace you. you're playing a game, and that game is, I'll figure out how to use it, and then I'll use it, and then I won't get replaced by it because they won't figure out how, they're going to figure out how to use it. And so that's why we should look at something that's already followed this adoption curve. And we can go technology after technology after technology and find the same type of adoption curve. I'm using the internet because it's the closest in time and the closest in technology effect to the AI revolution. But I could do what I'm about to do with the internet, with moving from not having electricity available to having electricity available. I could do it with the Gutenberg printing press and go that far back. I could do it with when the first sawmills were built that used water power to long saw board lumber and the sawmen went on strike. Okay. I could use it to the dawn of the age of the telephone, the dawn of the age of the television. Like, any major technological disruption follows a similar adoption curve, but the internet followed an adoption curve that is almost identical to the adoption curve we can see coming with AI, because they are so similar as to what they empower. So let's think about this just a little bit differently. The beginning of the internet, the beginning of the, and I know about ARCNET and the 70s and Al Gore and every, okay, look, when I say the beginning of the internet for today's discussion, I am talking about the modern internet as we know it, where you get on a computer, you can open up a browser. In the beginning, it was one that said, you've got mail, right? Okay, but you can open up a browser and you can go to a website. You can go to a different website and say, I'm looking for information about spark plugs or snakes or cars. And it would give you a list, maybe not a great list in the beginning, but a list of sites that did that. That you could easily send an email to your friends and back without having a degree in network administration. Like the internet you think of today, but just with less stuff on it. Right. If we go back to then, we're really looking kind of just surfacing and becoming that in about 1994. All right. And in 1994, what I'm about to play for you, and if you're on the video, you can see it. But if you're not on the video, I think it will be just as impactful just to hear the audio here. And it's really interesting. Just immediately look at the video and see it's like 4:3. It's square. Instead of widescreen, like that's just the tech we've forgotten. Like it's a de facto standard now. Everything's shot in a widescreen format. But this is anybody here remember when you got your first TV that was a widescreen TV instead of a square screen TV, and trying to make everything look right and fill the screen out? And when you did it all the way out, it distorted the image, and or you had to have it look like it was square and have all this black space. That's just another reinforcement of how technology changes. And I didn't even think of it till I pulled this up. But let me play this for you. This is the cast of Good Morning America trying to figure out what the at sign in an email address is and trying to figure out what internet even is. And they really have no idea. So let's take a gander at this.
Six pass. I wasn't prepared to translate that as I was doing that little tease.
Oh, that's
that
right.
Little mark with the A and then the ring around it.
At.
See, that's what I said.
Mm-hmm.
Kay said she thought it was about.
Yeah. Oh.
But I'd never heard
or
it.
Around.
I'd never heard it said. I'd always seen around. The mark, but never yeah. heard it said. And then yeah. it sounded stupid when I said it. Violence at NBC.
Yeah, I heard around or about in the lunchroom.
See, there it is. Violence at NBCGE.com. I mean.
Well, what Allison should know.
What
you
is internet
that,
anyway?
Internet is that. Massive computer
right.
network,
mm-hmm.
the one that's becoming really big now.
What do you mean that's big? How does one? What do you write to it like mail?
No, a lot of people use it and communicate. I guess they can communicate with NBC writers and producers. Allison, can you explain what internet is?
No, she can't say anything in 10 seconds or less.
Oh, Allison will be in the studio shortly.
What
does it mean?
It's a giant computer network made up of. Started from.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us what this was.
It's like a
in
computer
the
billboard.
It's not a. It's a computer billboard, but it's nationwide,
right.
And it's several universities and everything all joined together.
Right.
And others can access it.
And right.
And it's getting bigger and bigger all the time.
It came
great.
In really handy during the quake. A lot of people, that's how they were communicating out to tell family and loved ones they were okay because all the phone lines were down.
I was telling Katie, and I was
But you don't need about. You don't need that. You don't need a phone line to operate.
No.
No.
I love how the girl's like, you don't need a phone line to operate internet. And the other girl's like, no, no, no. She doesn't know anything. She has no idea what she's talking about because she has no idea how the internet works at all. And sort of kind of, yeah, you're right, but she has no idea why she's right. And at the time, if you were using the internet as an individual versus in sort of corporate data center or something, or corporate office that was set up by some IT guy running it that maybe had a straight data pipe coming in for the LAN, right? Then yeah, you needed a phone line. I know, like, there's cable internet and fiber. None of that existed. Everything at the consumer level at the time they were doing this was dial up. You've got mail. And they had no idea what they were talking about at all. And it was one of those times where people were still willing to admit that they didn't know what the hell they were talking about. Right? I mean, and that didn't last for long. All of these people became, supposed well-informed internet users overnight, but they didn't. It took a lot longer than memory says it did. And that's what's going to happen with AI. So that was the beginning. Then workplaces began to allow internet into the office. And they did so with very intent, at times very strict guidelines. Like, they would have their IT guy figure out, like, how do we make sure that they only use it to go to the company website or something like that? Like, that was literally a thing. You could only send emails through the company's software. So if that was Outlook or whatever, so it was all managed through their own server. And they didn't understand that people were still just randomly, like, the people implementing it even didn't understand it. And they didn't understand that the workers were just going to use it anyway and work around them. And when you told them to find something out, even before it was accepted that you look it up online, people were going to look it up online. And some people were going to be lazy and cut and paste information, and some were going to cut and paste and modify, and some were going to learn and then architect their own information. Like, all this happened, and there was no way to stop it. There was no way to stop it. And because eventually you had to realize, hey, we can't really completely control this. Maybe we can block some sites and stuff, but we can't prevent an employee who are asking to find us, let's say, a vendor to come in and paint our workspace to not look up people who do that. And we can't really have like a custom tailored thing that just approves things one off. So eventually they had to let it be. And then as people learned to use this technology, it just became natural that they used it at work. But it was very much resisted. Eventually, though, we ended up with a workplace that was built on intranets and internet. So the stuff that was designed to be used inside the company or accessed inside the company was on your intranet, right, where you're on the company's internal network. And then we also had access to the outside with the internet, and we could then use the totality of that together. But eventually that became, but this worker's not here, so they can actually use the internet to securely access our intranet when they're remote. Now, this wasn't as common as it is today, but it instantly happened for people like me because I was a regional salesperson. And so I was never at the office. The office was in one case, San Jose. In another case, the office was in Seattle, and I lived in Texas or Pennsylvania. I'm not going to the office to do my on-the-company network work. Now, this doesn't seem like a big deal. Duh, of course. And that's my point. That's where everybody is today. Well, duh. You do it that way. This was not seamless, and it was an instant. And one of the reasons that people from kind of a remote worker sales background, the remote jobs that existed before they were commonplace for a lot of things, You always have had people doing that kind of work that had to be remote. How do you have a national sales force if you don't have remote sales management? And the answer is you can't. So they kind of gave that concession to people like me before we even had all the tools that we had by, let's say, 2000. We were still doing it. People had, we just call in fax. I remember faxing purchase orders in, even when we had the internet. I still remember having you can't email a purchase order. Okay, Frank, I'll print it out from the email my customer sent it to me in, and then I'll put it on the fax machine and fax it into you because that's the way you're running your office. That was a real conversation I had with somebody I worked for that was president of the company in 1999. I will take this purchase order from a technology company, like a very advanced technology company like Alcatel, to buy our very advanced product. And even though it was in an email and that's what they use, I'll print it out and fax it to you. That was that overlap where companies were just not embracing the technology yet, but people were using it anyway, and everybody was using it at different levels, and there was no way to stop it. Okay? Today, almost no company runs without constant use of the internet and associated technology, like social media for marketing, virtual meeting technologies like Zoom. Like, it is the default, de facto standard. You're going to start a company today. You're going to open a new office. The first thing you do is set up internet. Internet for the outside and a network for the inside, and the two working together. It's not even a concept that you would have an office without an internet connection. It would be like having an office without electricity, right? I guess if you are a blacksmith recreating the 15th century or something, you could do that. But even those guys mostly have internet, right? It's a de facto standard. Then the early adopters, I want to think about the 1990s and the people who adopted internet early and said, I'm going to use it in my job, whether you tell me to or not. I'm going to use it in my job, even if you tell me I'm not supposed to. I'm going to actually go look up information and use it to help speed up my decision making. I'm going to go research my competitors that you told me not to research on their website, that they have this better than ours, but it tells me all the things their products do. And I'm going to gear my presentations to overcome objections before they happen. Right. I am going, in my case, for instance, okay, you guys have set up these regional things and you send an email to all the people that have come to them in the past and we're supposed to go present at them. And, you know, you go through all these trade associations to put butts in seats. But I'm going to set up my own landing pages and I'm going to put more people in the seats than you can by yourself. And I'm not going to ask your permission. I'm just going to do it. Right. There were lots of us like that. And many of us were people at higher levels of management. And many of us were early remote workers. Again, regional sales management and things like that, even just regional sales people, because they were not inside the mothership, they had the ability to have the autonomy, so they chose to do it. And eventually, those people, those early adopters, look at where they are now. Like, if you look at anybody that, like, built a company from the ground up using the internet as their primary way to do it, they're all early adopters. We are hitting that point of the adoption curve for the internet. Like, we're very mature into this now. We're three decades into this now, where people now are starting from ground zero and building a company. But the people that adopted early, they were the first people to move from the consumer side of information to the production side of information. They're podcasters that make more money than doctors, right? Not all doctors, not surgeons, but general practice doctors. I'm not bragging or trying to sound really important or anything, but just this technology allows a guy who sits in his wife's office while his is being remodeled to sit down in front of a microphone and a computer and make more money than a person who went to medical school. Flatly. I'm sorry, it's true. And how many stories like that are there? And the ones that have grown into true empires of some sort, whether it's a little micro empire like mine or great big companies, they were all early adopters. They got out so far ahead of the curve that by the time everybody jumped onto it, they had already built their own wave that they were riding. And on top of this, no one today will admit to being anti-immigrant internet in the beginning. I can't find anybody. I can't find a single one. Yeah, when that internet thing started, I was like, it's a fad. I completely rejected it. I said it would never be anything. And I'm talking about professionals anyway. I can't find any. I can't find a single CEO that's, you know, there's plenty of them that are 20 years older than me and still working. Like, that will say, hey, yeah, I got it wrong. It's all, well, we always knew. Here's the thing. We all know that's not true. We all know that's not true. We all know what really happened. We all know how many people actually just said, this is stupid. No one's going to do it. Here's a real world story of something exactly like that happening. And every high-level decision maker that could be reached. Of every auto manufacturer basically in the world rejected it, even though it was being handed to them. There's a local radio host who recently retired after like four decades of doing something. His name's Ed Wallace, and he had a show called Wheels. He came out of the car industry. He's run dealerships, et cetera. And he did kind of like this once-a-week radio show that was kind of like a car and driver magazine with a local tie-in, right? Where here's the new cars, here's what's going on, but if you want to buy one of these, there's some good dealerships you can go to that I've worked with and I recommend. But even if you deal with somebody else, here's the questions to ask. A very, very articulate guy, very smart guy, very much a subject matter expert on vehicles. And somewhere around 94, 96, this guy looks at the internet as it's coming up and goes, oh my God, people are going to buy everything on this internet thing. So he figures out how to build the very first ever complete end-to-end car shopping platform on the internet. And he makes it vendor agnostic. Since he was a dealer and he has all these dealer contacts, he has access to all the part numbers, all the information as to engines, options, etc. So he builds it so that you can have a flat table database and you just upload that and attach it to it. And I can sit down and if I'm looking for a Chevy, be like, I want a Chevy Camaro. I want it to be blue. Oh, here's my colors of blue that it comes in. I want the V8. I don't want the V6. I want the optimized one. I want leather seats. And you could pick out the whole car and it would show you a picture of what your car looked like, right? And then you could order it or you could print that out and go to your dealer and go, this is what I want. He took it to Ford. He took it to Chevy. He took it to all the GM options, to Buick and Pontiac and what have you. He took it to, you know, Dodge. He took it to Toyota. He took it to Honda. He took it to Hyundai. He took it to Subaru. He took it to everybody. And you know what they all said? Yeah, this has been mid-late 90s. No one's ever going to buy a car online, you big dumbass. Take that shit and get it away from us. Today, every single car dealership, let alone car manufacturer, has a website just like that. They couldn't see it. But none of those people will say, that was me. Not a single, everybody just knows now, right? Do you really think this is going to be any different? This is going to be any different at all? Because it's not. And they're still talking about my web host here. And this is why I won't even throw out a name for you yet. Bluehost. No, you don't understand the kind of hosting that I have to have. If you're talking about Bluehost, this is enterprise class dedicated server hosting that you have to do to run a show like this, right? Not everything's on YouTube that I do. Moving on though. Today, the most personally sovereign people and the most controlled people both use the same internet. They just use it differently. The people that are out saying the things they want to say, broadcasting what they're saying, and being heard and finding an audience use the internet. And the people that just sit and believe whatever their chosen source, CNN, MSNBC, whomever, whether it's a tech website or whatever, they just consume it. The people that are out getting a message out with social media are using social media as a content creator. And the people that are being controlled by social media are exclusively consumers, even if they think they're active and participating. Even people that are not creating content on social media, the ones that dial in how to find good sources of information, competing sources of information, and use it as a tool to monitor and decision make, those people have personal sovereignty. The people that just follow their own bias or just accept whatever is served up to them, they're being controlled. So you have about, and I'm going to say it's almost a 50-50 split. You have about half of society that's literally controlled by media, both internet and like television, but that line's blurring. Okay. That line's blurring to where you can watch TV on the internet. You can watch the internet on TV. I mean, you get what I'm saying. Okay. And then you have people that see this as like, wait a minute, I can know anything. I can find information about anything. I can compile data from multiple sources and make a better decision. whether I'm trying to figure out how to take my company to the next level and reach out and find the information that's available from people who already did it, or I'm trying to figure out how to change a part on a car and I've never done it before, and some 18-year-old shade tree mechanic will show me exactly where to find it on my Volkswagen. All of it. That autonomy is by the people that pull the information that they want in the way that they need it when they want it to accomplish their goals versus those who sit and receive what they're delivered. And I'm going to say it's about 50-50. Maybe it's 60-40, something like that, okay, where it's like 40% are in control and 60% aren't. Now, I'm not saying that 40 or 50% of people in society are true, complete, independent thinkers. I'm just saying functionally, they are at least engaging proactively in discerning what they pull in and filtering it through a question lens of, does this make sense? Does this track? Does this help me? Those are the motivated people, yeah? So let's look at AI and find the similarities and where we're at right now. So I would say AI for prime time for the average person is 3 years old today. You're going back to late 2022 to 2023 with the introduction of things like ChatGPT and Llama and Google Gemini, et cetera, and more platforms come out after that. But I'm going to say that by like 2024, a large percent of the population had at least tried AI in some way. They went to ChatGPT and they asked a question and they got an answer. They liked or they didn't like, doesn't matter. But they tried it kind of the way that people tried Yahoo or Google for the first time. Hotel in Indiana, you know, Indianapolis, Indiana. Oh, well, there's actually, oh, okay. Yeah, I see what this does. Maybe it doesn't do everything, but there's some functionality in it for you. I mean, by 2024, my wife was using, and she's not technical at all, ChatGPT to translate a book written in sort of a older dialect of Dutch that actually blended German in with it. That was complicated even for someone that was a native Dutch speaker to actually translate for us. So that's what I mean when I say we're in kind of that early adopter phase, but most people have touched it at least. Okay. And I would say that puts us now at about 1998 to 1999 as the internet adoption curve. It's accepted that it's a thing. People are betting on it, but people are still resisting it. And companies are very much trying to keep a lid on it. Okay. Workplaces are only allowing AI use mostly right now with a lot of oversight, or they have proprietary AI models that are locked into basically being a dynamic FAQ so that they can handle customer service or something like that. Or they have an AI bot that, you know, when you can't find something on that intranet we were talking about, like where is the data for X stored, it'll give you a map and tell you how to get there, right? They're not, I'm going to say there's always companies that innovate, but the majority of companies now are not telling their employees, hey, here's access to an AI tool. Use it. Use it in your daily workflow, right? Or giving guidance for how to do that. They're not doing that yet. So we went from, with internet, we went from no internet to kind of we have to have it for email and for like company updates and stuff like that and storing data to, hey, you can use it, but you have to use it this way. Hey, you can use it, but you better not do this with it too. We have the internet and we have certain sites we don't want you on, so we'll block those, but otherwise it's just a tool you have. It's Excel, right? It's Microsoft Word. You don't bring somebody in and say, hey, you can only use Word the way I say. You can only use Excel the way I say. You say, are you experienced with using word processing and spreadsheet software? Yes. Okay. Go do that. That's what you train them in their individual job, but you expect them to be able to use a technological tool. That's where the internet is today. We're not there with AI yet, but that's where you have to go to because there's no way to get rid of it. We still have lots of people calling it a fad. Lots of people that still say it's a fad. Or they attack it for errors and flaws. Well, I asked it this and it got the wrong answer. Have you ever searched for a website or you searched for a fact online and the first thing you found was wrong? Come on. Aren't you supposed to use your God-given brain to actually discern and filter things? See, the problem is that because everybody had the sci-fi version of AI in their head, instead of seeing it as a tool, they saw it as a genie, and they didn't like the genie. So when the genie failed to give me my wish test, they could just say, no, write it off. It's not going to work. It's not going to happen. And if you've been using it, then you've, one, learned to use it better so your results are better. But two, because you're more operationally efficient with it, your results are dynamically better than the new adopter today. And you also know how much better it is. There's lots of little things you start seeing. When you start seeing things like Gemini using some level of ability to know who you are based on your past chats with them, and having not full access to prior chats, but more access than something like GPT does, and you see the game changer that is. And then you know, well, OpenAI and ChatGPT have to do that too. And so you start seeing more of what's coming, and because you've seen where it started to where it is, where most people on the outside still, even if they think they use it, when they're not using it in an operational manner, they really don't see much different other than, oh, those little short videos look cooler now. Those little short videos, until somebody figures out exactly what to do with them, are pointless. They're parlor tricks. They're like, hey, I remember one of the first big viral things that happened with the internet were these little cartoons. Remember Joe's Cartoons? And like this email went around and everybody in the office was wasting time with it. It was like it was a frog in a blender, right? And then you hit different little, it was a flash animation and the frog mocked you as you turned up the speed on the blender until he completely got eviscerated, right? Like, did that make anybody any money? No. It did open people's mind as like, well, what else can we create that's actually useful? This is where we are. This is where we are. Have you seen any of that flash little games and shit going around anymore? That's all dead. Some of you are too young to remember this. There was a game where you were Santa and you were bowling using an elf as a bowling ball. There was a game where you were you're growing marijuana in Jamaica, and you were shooting down the parachuting agents that were setting your fields on fire. There was one called I remember it was called now, but there was like you were fighting like terrorists in Afghanistan during that time period, like early on. Like there was all this stuff, and it was so viral and whatever, and it made nobody any money. Use Grok Imagine today, says Elon Musk, and make this video of an angel with a sword and a swirl around it. Yeah, but what does it do? It's up to us to figure out what it does. And like I said, to plug that in at an operational level in our life. And we're just getting there. We're just getting there with that. The other thing about this, though, and this is hurting adoption. The dot-com boom, so as we switched into that from that mid-90s internet of what is that at thing mean, what is that, what is internet, when we left that behind and people like understood like, oh, we can actually exchange information with this, we can actually find places to do business, we can actually buy stuff. And as that became evident that that's where this was going, and the Debbie Downers kind of like just silent, they didn't die, they just quieted down and pretended they never were. Then we got this massive pump and dump of tech stocks. And to do that, we had to like, the internet will take over everything. It will do everything, you know, and it will replace all the brick and mortar stores. Everything's going to be online. Nobody's going to like, and some of it was so over the top that many people became more resistant because like, that's bullshit. And I want the whole thing to be bullshit. So I'm going to embrace the actual bullshit and use it to shield myself from reality. It's exactly where we are with AI right now. We're in the exact same place. And again, that is hurting us because what they're pitching is AI is going to cure cancer. Well, first of all, you don't cure cancer. You cure a particular kind of cancer because there's thousands of kinds of cancer. And AI is not going to cure any of them. A human using AI as a tool, who also has deep bioengineering knowledge and pharmaceutical knowledge, is going to cure a specific type of cancer using AI as one of the tools to get there. That's not exciting. That doesn't get people to go into an IPO and buy a bunch of stock on some company that's going to lose because they put AI in the name. So you get this hype. 1999 to 2000, if you were around and old enough to like own stock and have a 401k plan, you know what happened next. And everybody said, it's over. I told you it was a fad. And the people that were locked in on it and were holding stocks like, you know, Google and Amazon went, okay, fine. Have fun staying poor. Just saying, it's a repeating pattern. And in the end, the internet didn't win as the internet. See, we have this tendency to look at things and just homogenize them. Well, the internet took over the world. No, the internet enabled people to take a bigger piece of the world and to have access to more of the world. It didn't take over the world. The internet actually won because the internet was able to win through leveraging platforms, applications, and other opportunity as leverage tools. In other words, all of a sudden, a person could go into the information marketing business from their house and they weren't, you know, licking and sticking envelopes to respond to stuff out of classified ads. They were able to deliver a product at the speed of light and receive payment at the speed of light. Platforms like PayPal revolutionized everything because a person that was so new that when they tried to get an account to accept Visa, MasterCard, Amex, etc., and they were told to go blow, PayPal's like, here, just use us. It's PayPal, and hey, we'll design it so we basically are taking the credit card for you, and you get it into your PayPal account. And the next thing you know, every person that wanted to put a payment button on a website could. So is that the internet, or is that an application that runs on the internet? And it's the second one. It's an application that runs on the internet. We have people today that make a living from nothing but making short video content. That's a platform, Instagram, TikTok, whatever. And then other, I promise you, anybody that's actually making money doing that, they're leveraging other tools to do it. You only see them in that one place, but there's a leverage game that's happening there as well. But the biggest winners in internet disruption moved from consumer to creator in some way. And that wasn't just people with independent businesses like me. The people that stayed in jobs used the internet as a tool of their creative process to produce something internally in their company or for their company to market externally. So you can be a creator and have a job. I mean, we've made the term kind of a generic thing. If you say I'm a creator today, then most people think you mean internet and they think of you as somebody that's probably making videos or podcasts or blog posts or something. Right. They don't tend to think of what that, if I said I am a creator in 1985, you would have said, okay, what do you create? Today you would say, like, do you create video or do you create audio or do you create art? Like, you would already be dialed into this person is using internet platforms to deliver something. But that's not the only way to be a creator. Again, let's go back to one of my first sales jobs. I was a sales engineer for a company that structured cabling. And I would look at what the customer had and they, you know, sometimes they knew they'd have blueprints and where they wanted everything. But a lot of times they'd be like, well, we're going to come in here. And the blueprint they had was simply, here's where all the desks are. And this is what we think we need. And I would completely design their infrastructure for them, their data and voice cabling infrastructure, where their telecom closets were, what the suspension of the cabling in the ceiling would look like, the type of patch panels and jacks they would use, the type of patch cables, what a workstation would be like when delivered. Like, I would design all of that, and I would give them a price. And then if I closed that deal, then my company would send in a technical team with a project manager and build that out. So the whole company was a creator. We were creating the design and implementation of a network. And I was a part of that creative process. And my creation was to actually design what the text would build. Still a creator. And so I'm not saying to be successful with AI at the highest level now, you need to become a digital creator in the model of, you know, a TikToker or a podcaster or anything like that. I'm saying that you need to be using it for output rather than just for input. And the output still must be your own. So today I could take a lot of that data and compile it with tools and get that RFP out or respond to that RFP or RFQ faster, but I still have to be the one that's responsible for it. I still have to know what makes sense and what doesn't. I still have to have an idea about the quality of different manufacturer's components, and I have to understand the customer's needs. But now I can just move that faster and better and give more optionality to my final recommendation. And that's what I mean by moving into the creator landscape. So the real killer application, though, is what it can do to the individual. And what I am proposing is if we are going to get the most out of AI, we need to look at AI as an individual leadership and managerial training program. That doesn't mean that everybody that uses AI is going to become a great leader. It's not going to equalize everybody, right? What was the God made men, but Sam Colt made them equal? Because of the peacemaker, right? The 45. But did it make men equal? It equalized for a time, just based on the landscape of the time, people a little bit more. But it didn't make them equal. Both guys have the same tool. One's better with it. Some will abuse the tool. Some will use it responsibly. Some just simply having the tool in case they need it will prevent them from ever having to use it. It's not the same across the board, is it? It doesn't homogenize just because that's the way that we think. So when I say it's a leadership training tool, I mean that if you have any leadership in you at all, it'll make you a better leader. If you have any potential to manage other people in you at all, it will help you become a manager before you are given the opportunity to do so with people by creating your own agency of custom agents, helpers, etc., and learning how to manage set expectation flow and how to alter and optimize that so that you get the best output. And so as an early AI adopter, the most important thing you can learn right now is to be a good prompt architect and learn how to create virtual teams of advisors, helpers, assistants, coaches, and consultants. And I know the pushback on that is, but what if AI hallucinates? Well, this is why you need a team. Okay. And this is why you need some knowledge of what you're doing. Whenever people push back on this, it's always like, it always sounds like what they think you're saying is, I'm going to have a guy start designing your office network who doesn't know what an RJ45 jack is. We're just going to hire him and give him AI and say, tell AI to give us, you know, what we need and to evaluate the requests when they come, the bids when they come in and help me pick a contractor and it'll just be fine. It's not what we're saying at all. I mean, for the corporations that are looking at this and thinking this is dangerous, it's renegade, right? It's everybody doing their own thing. It's chaos. It's nonsense. You hire a person into a position like a junior analyst, right? Because they're capable of doing that work. If they happen to use other tools to do that work better and faster, tempered by their own judgment, and they still report to somebody who takes that data input that they bring them, right? And is supposed to vet it themselves before they either implement it or hand it up to be implemented. It's pressure tested before it gets handed up. In other words, I've heard people actually object to this, and I'm like, so what you're telling me is you would object to the fact that somebody came into you as one of your direct reports and said, I have an idea for an initiative. This is what it is. This is how it works. This is the risk mitigation. These are the primary risks that we have against it. This is how it plays into what our competition's doing. And when you started asking them questions, they had well thought out reasoned answers to all of those questions. And on top of a one page brief that outlined it, they had thicker data behind it. And they said, look, I'm not saying this is perfect. I'm bringing it to you to see if this has legs. Can we work on this together? Is this something we can do? You would be mad. Well, not if they did it like that. What the hell did you think they were going to do? What did you think they were going to do? Order a new fleet of vehicles for the company and say that AI told them to do it? That person is a, you should have hired that person. They should have never made it through your hiring filter. The person that's predisposed to do something like that. That's not what we're talking about. And to do this, you have to take a different approach. And this is something that new managers constantly struggle with. And because of that, again, companies are resistant to this message because they know that new managers struggle with setting and holding people to expectations. But why? Why are they not good at that? Maybe it's because I'm gonna pause for a second. I'm gonna talk about this. AI synthetic data. When AI does not know, it gives you a synthetic. That's because you don't know how to use it. That's because you don't have any data on the subject matter. That's because you don't have a bullshit detector. That's because you're trying to do work you're not qualified to do. Just because I give you a power saw, it does not turn you into a construction expert. A guy with a handsaw will outproduce you if he knows how to put buildings together and frame, and you don't. So just because the tool's better does not make the operator better unless the operator is capable of doing the work in the first place. Does that make sense? See, and in that statement, and I don't know the person making it at all, so they might not be making it for a purpose other than they're just kind of stating it for whatever, okay? But that's usually the type of statement that's like, this is bullshit. It doesn't work. No, you don't know how to use the tool. I give one person power tools, nailing guns, right? Bolts and screws and nails, saws, measuring devices, marking devices, and say, hey, go do something. They build a tiny house. I give somebody else the exact same tools. They end up at the ER with a board nailed to their hand. Is it the tool's problem? Or is it an operational layer problem because you have to learn how to use the tool before you can be trusted to use the tool without hurting yourself or others? Which one is it? Okay? So that's the mindset we have to stay in. Instead of this, let's look for a flaw. Let's look for a bad output. The same person that says this is never going to say, I don't use the internet because sometimes when I look up the internet, the first page that I find on the internet to give me an answer for that gives me the wrong answer. No, they say I use the internet. And when I find an answer that doesn't make sense, I try to confirm it or disprove it, and I keep doing research until I figure out what is most likely true. Do you think it's any different? Because it's not. And that's where we've oversold it. We have created this idea of this super intelligent machine instead of a tool that has access to lots of information and a new type of interface, because that's what it really is. It's not intelligent. It's fake intelligence. Artificial means fake, okay? So when results are not what you want, as a leader, that's all on you. And it starts with setting rock solid expectations. The problem is we set an expectation in our head. We know what we meant. The AI takes what we said quite literally, and it does have some missing human nuance. So we're not talking about Elon Musk Neuralink here and plugging our brain into a computer, interfacing directly back and forth. Like, we're a long way from that. I don't know if I'm ever up for that kind of shit, right? I don't know if I'm. People always say, would you have a chip put in your brain? Probably not. And they're like, what do you mean probably? Well, if I'm paralyzed from the waist down and I can't walk and that chip will let me walk, I may very well do it. But they could program you with, yeah, the ability to walk, okay? And I'm willing to risk the other shit for the ability to walk, yeah? But that's not what this is. So that AI unit cannot possibly know what – I'm going to star that for later, man, and I'll come back to you. It can't possibly know what you mean unless you're very explicit about what you mean. And this is where prompt architecture is very important. And when you create a prompt and it doesn't give you the type of results you're looking for, especially when you're creating these master prompts that I talk about, we're actually creating this own AI entity with a specific background, specific knowledge base, and specific role to play in your world of, and you define its tasks. Even when you do that very specifically, you often look at the result and go, this isn't really what I had in mind. At that point, you have to be able to dissect what the problem is. Just like a computer programmer has to look at code that almost does what they wanted it to, but doesn't quite, or it spits out an error, or their users say, Nine times out of 10, it works. And 10% of the time, it throws this error. They have to debug it. It's much easier to debug, but it's still a debugging process. And once you lock it in, you want to save that framework in some manner so it can be reused over and over and over again, or they can be the base of creating something new. But sometimes what will happen is you'll get to a point where this thing I built doesn't really do the thing that I need it to do anymore because what I need doing has changed. Basically, you're going to fire and replace just like an employee. There's at points where you go, this person's okay, and they do a good job for what they do, but they're not right for this company anymore, or they're not right for this team anymore. They're going to get reassigned, or they're going to get released. It sucks, but it's the way it works, and it's just the way that it works. And they get sent to do something somewhere else, or they're retrained so that they can be useful. And so with an AI model, we do the same thing. We either upgrade it, or we bring in someone new, and we manage that. But we have to be clear on the expectations. Now, when I talk to people in business and they say, and you tell them this, they say, I have enough trouble with my employees that are managers doing that well in the first place. Now you want some entry-level person to do it with a computer. Yes, I absolutely do. So by the time you bring that person up a level and you give them some direct reports, they have fucking done it before, to be blunt. Now, they've done it in a sandbox. They're in a safe space. Right. Again, you don't hand them the Amex card to the company and let them start ordering new materials in to replace office furniture. Nobody's saying anything like that. But you do give them their assignments and you do say, hey, build a team to do this with and learn how to do it. And as they bring that back, it goes through the same filtering layered process the company already has in place. You just start using this tool at all the levels to improve the performance of the people that have the experience to be able to use it for that particular thing. This is not hard to understand. The people who do not understand it do so mainly today because they do not wish to understand it. They don't want to understand it because they don't want it to be what it is, and they want it to go away, which, again, is the pattern continuously and constantly repeating itself. Your agents that you create, your helpers, your assistants, whatever, okay, they are going to be wrong at times. They're going to kiss your ass. And you have to manage expectations through both. And you might want someone that's kind of a yes man for one part of your team. You might want a creative assistant that leans into anything you suggest. Yeah, that's really great. What if we added this? Okay, and you could do this and this and that, right? You might want that person. But you also want, and if you've ever managed teams, this naturally occurs with just enough bodies. You want the person that's always like, yeah, I see where you're going there, but what about this risk? What about this danger? What do you do about it? Right? You want the criticizer, and then you want the problem solver. You want the problem solver who sits back. That's usually the guy in a meeting, doesn't talk much at first. He just sits there, and he just listens, and he takes it all in, and he hears the energetic leader that wants to get everybody going. He hears the idea guy who jumps in with the leader and says, do, 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 do. Right. And then he listens to the guy that points out, usually accurately, even if he's too negative, he does do one thing well. Here's the risks. Here's the things that can go wrong. And the problem solver comes in and goes, let's synthesize this. And says, look, why don't we take these ideas and run with those? This one is too risky right now. And we have to do these other ones first. So let's start with these first two as a test bed that leads to the third if it works. And here's how we mitigate those risks. Now, this is where it all breaks down. Everybody in that meeting who hasn't been properly trained on this process, which most haven't, because otherwise they'd be at the head of that table, is thinking to the, or unless it's a group of middle managers that actually manage and they've gotten good at it, what they all think is, I did the thing. You didn't do shit in reality. You provided the leader the information they needed to synthesize everybody's ideas, use their experience and their instincts and the authority that they have to act and take that action with confidence at their level and then be responsible for it to those above them and responsible to make you do what you said you could do. That's how you manage AI. It is exactly how you manage AI to get the optimal results for it. And I have developed this over 3 years, and this final piece has only come in about the past 6 months. And this is why, okay, this is actually great here. Anarchy says, that's me, he's describing. I'm the problem solver guy. Okay, so that's great. So that's your strength. Okay, but that doesn't make you a good leader. So now what you have to do is take your problem solving guy persona, layer on top of it leadership, and then you have to build your team of advisors and whatever you're trying to do that plays to your weaknesses, not your strengths. You need idea guy, right? You need well thought out, well reasoned, excited, throw everything at the wall idea guy, and you need curmudgeon guy. You need guy that won't work because you're stupid. But here's actually, beyond you being stupid, here's the reasons why you're stupid. You're overlooking this, 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 and this. Problem solver guy goes, this, the first reason you said he's stupid is wrong. This second reason is accurate but mitigatable. And this third reason is half right. If we plug that back in and we look at it through that filter and we take his other idea and apply that here, and if leadership's willing to get behind this, and if we can have enough budget here, this is what a solution might look like. And then everybody sits back, and if they're smart, when somebody says something that involved, the next thing that everybody should say for about at least 10 seconds is not a fucking word. When that person, as long as they're actually good at what they do, speaks, their first pass at fixing everything will sound great, and it will almost inevitably also still be flawed. But it will advance, it advances the puck down the ice, okay? It moves you in the right direction. That restarts the whole process all over again. And you continually run that until some level of consensus is reached, and eventually the leader goes, okay, I pay all you fuckers, go back to work and do your main job and take away the initiatives you were given in this meeting and get those done and get reported back to me, and I own it now. Okay. And then people say, like, you can't have a whole company full of people like that. Nobody has yet. And you never probably will, because most people are going to be laggards and hard to push to be that motivated. But if you build a company with 20% of the people like that in it, it's unstoppable. And it will become 50% of the people like that in it, because you will have to swim with everybody else at their speed and their pace, or you're going to wash out. And most companies of any size have a relatively high turnover rate in the worker bee category anyway. And that's the other half. They will find their place in the conformist, I do what I'm told, I do what I'm asked, and I show up on time, space, or they'll get completely washed out because what they're being asked to do is more than they're comfortable doing, and they'll go find somewhere where they're comfortable. And that's totally okay. That's totally okay. So in the end, when you're using AI this way, just like a leader in a company that's two or three rungs up in an organization has, let's say, five direct reports, and each of those five direct reports has 10 direct reports, right? That guy is over a sizable organization inside the organization. But when he, I don't care what his group of five have brought from their teams, gleaned and recommended, when he looks at that in the end and they have that meeting we just talked about, and he says, you know what, we're going to take this initiative and run with it, and he feeds what they're going to do up, and he feeds what needs to be done down, he owns it. He owns it. And when you are one man doing this and you hand it off up, you also own what you said you could do, and you own the recommendation. And if you don't think that is a leadership training program that is a natural result of maximizing technology to what it can do for you today, it is either you have, I'm sorry to put it this way, you either have an IQ too low to comprehend that, which is going to be somewhere in the 70 range, or you don't want it to be true. You don't want this revolution to be happening. You don't want this disruption to come. And you know what they say about wanting in one hand and taking a dump in the other? I'll let you go for yourself with that one. The company that gets this changes its culture and upgrades its human capital almost overnight. Almost overnight. Now, it's not that fast, but it'll feel like it when you track it through a single year. The company that embraces this and says, let's define how to do this for people based on where they are. You're not going to give somebody more authority or more decision-making capacity that they've demonstrated the competence to have if you know how to run a company. You're already not going to do that. So you say, this is what we think you can do. This is your authority layer right now. To stop micromanaging, we stop telling them how to use that layer, how to get up to that layer, how to find the answer up to that layer. And then they own their decisions, right? You're not going to have a 50,000 person company and some guy that's an entry level data technician tank the company stock because of a decision he made only because he used AI. That's a nonsense objection, but it's one that's being sounded off in boardrooms right now because I do deep research into this and I'm paying attention to what's being said about it. And again, the similarities to what people were saying in the offices I worked in from, let's say, 96 up to about 2006 are dramatically the same thing. Dramatically the same thing. And you know the other thing that you start to realize, the other pattern that repeats? The people who didn't want it but finally came along for the ride and now they're kind of playing along, they're telling you things as though they're new that are 3 years old. I want you to think about it this way, right? Remember, like, all the people that said the internet was a fad? By the time they embraced the internet, those were the people that when they gave a website, they're like, it's www.soandso.com. And every time they said, instead of saying something like, oh, it's survivalpodcast.com. Oh, it's tspass.com. www. Because they were so left behind from where the first movers began. That when they jumped on board, they had to kind of pretend that they knew what they were talking about. And that was one of those things. How bad was it? I'm glad you asked. During a time I was working with a company called Sage Telecom, which was a competitive local phone service provider. They also had a dial-up internet service, even though by then most people were moving over to DSL and what have you. However, they were very active in the rural markets, and there were plenty of people left who had no choice but to use dial-up internet. They couldn't get any form of high-speed internet yet. That was a thing for a long time. And so we rolled out this dial-up internet, and we developed an email campaign to move people from like AOL or whatever over to our Sage Telecom brand of internet. And this required culling from our database targeted customers. And we had a data analyst who did that. And he brought that data to me, and I developed the email campaign to convert these people. It's very, very effective. One of the things we had to do was run a filter to take www. off about, I'm going to say, 3 to 5% of the email addresses. Yeah, like if it was like joe@aol.com, the person in the web form, when they filled it out and it ended up in our database, said www.joe@aol.com. And I remember Tim, the analyst, was like, you can actually, I'm like, no, you didn't, nobody did that on purpose. We just need to go in and just cut that off, run a script and cut that off everything. So he did. And then we had very high deliverability on those email addresses. That's how bad it was. That's where we're sitting right now. We have people that are the equivalent of the person who would tell you the website and they like concentrated www.foxnews.com, right? That person today is the one pointing out, but AI hallucinates. And everybody that's a power user of AI is like, no shit. We all know that. In fact, we all have safeguards and rails put in place to help us identify when that hallucination is coming. One of those is simply, are you being honest with me? That's one of those. Building source finders and saying, hey, here's a bunch of sources I was just given. Go verify these sources. And that source finder coming back and going, valid, valid, invalid, valid, valid, invalid. Not what it says, does it exist? Because it hallucinates so bad, sometimes it'll give you websites, articles, etc., and a URL, and there's nothing there. You can go check them alone, or you can build an agent that does that for you. You can build an agent that helps you edit your writing but doesn't rewrite it for you. It will say, in paragraph 4, where you said this, you might want to look at the structure there. That's incredibly valuable, but you have to build a tool for it. And building a tool is as simple as building the right prompts and then using those prompts consecutively and then categorizing your discussions and being able to say, here's the last two discussions we had when you're using that master prompt that creates that entity. This brings you up to speed of where we're at now, and this is where we're going next. And if you do that, you're going to get much better results. What we're at now is the typical thing that comes in a technology adoption curve. We can't use it till it's perfect. What's perfect? Can an employee right now send an email that damages your company? Do you have somebody that sits in a 20,000 person company and watches every email being sent and reads it and approves it before it's sent? No? Well, how is your company still in business? How is your company still in business? How did you not go out of business when an employee who knows nothing about a subject can email information about that subject incorrectly to another influential person somewhere in the world that could use it to destroy you? Because you have systems and protocols in place that outline and set the expectations to an employee. This is your wheelhouse. This is where you stay, and you don't go. This is where you don't go. I'm just suggesting you say inside your wheelhouse, use AI to be better. And I'm suggesting for the people who work for companies that haven't figured this out, do it anyway. Do it anyway, and do it as much for your personal edification as for your job. In other words, be a better person, and you will be a better employee. Get your shit together with economics so that you can look forward and say, if I just stay on the path that I'm on, I'm going to have a comfortable retirement. And if I do better, I'm going to have a fantastic retirement. You're going to be a better employee. And if you decide to go the entrepreneur route, you're going to be a better entrepreneur. Look at your health. Build an advisor or even several advisors that help you improve your health. I didn't say turn into some jackass guy or something. I'm just saying be better than you are. The beauty of dialing these agents is you can bring them down to where you are and say, make me 2% better a month. Improve my outcomes by 2% a month. Or maybe, hey, in the first couple months, since I suck, I have lots of room to improve. Maybe I can be 50% better in the first month, 25% better in the second month. Then I'm going to kind of hit like a wall, and I'm going to come down to like 5% improvement. And eventually my lifelong improvement in this one aspect is 2 to 3%. You can't afford to hire coaches to do that for you. Billionaires do. Multi-millionaire athletes do. You can't. But now you can spin them up, and you learn how to manage a team. Right? Now, will this mean that you have to manage, you know, Sally who cries every time you criticize her work? No. Training programs never fully, completely, 100% simulate what you'll experience when it's actually on your back. Can't be done. In the Army, when we went to combat lifesavers training, you know, you got a guy with fake blood on him, and you know, he's had a sucking chest wound. But when you check for it, they have to tell you what you hear and what you see and what you feel and what you smell. Like somebody does that for you. Or the person that's playing the casualty, if they can speak in the scenario, knows what to say in response to your questions. Plus the things that they can't say, again, there's an instructor sitting there saying, you hear this, the heartbeat is thready, whatever it is. Okay. There's another instructor going, you're killing him. He's going to die. He's not going to go home because you're stupid. You have to tune him out. Okay. It still does not prepare you for the day that you see somebody get a compound fracture, and it's not even combat. It's some sort of training or day-to-day work, and they have a bone sticking out of their leg. But you're better prepared than had you not had that training. Okay? So when I say it's a leadership and management training program incognito, I mean that it gets you a hell of a lot closer than you would be without any of that experience. And again, back to what I was saying, that middle managers, upper management, ownership, directors often will point out if you go into that world, but we already have enough trouble getting my managers to do this well in the first place. They're terrible at it. It takes a long time to gain that experience. So if they started with more experience, might they learn how to do it quicker? Because I found that in general, when somebody I put in a management position would come to me and say, I'm not getting much out of this person, especially with somebody that I interviewed as part of the hiring process. And I would be like, you know, Eric's a good dude. We hired him to do copy and he writes good copy. Well, I'm not getting the results I expect. Does he know what those are? Well, yeah, I told him. Are you sure? Are you sure? Why don't we sit down and you tell me the last conversation you think you had with Eric? And he'd go through it. And I go, now show me what his results are and what you're not getting. And they would show me. And I'd go, well, assuming you even were that thorough, which you probably weren't, because you're probably more thorough with me because you're afraid of me, I can see where this happened. Did you sit down with Eric and say, I'm not happy with your work, make it better? Or did you sit down and outline where Eric got it wrong and how to improve it so that it would meet with your approval? Well, I mean, I didn't go to that layer. I don't micro. No, then you have not set expectations properly. Therefore, it's not on Eric. It's on you. Okay, when you use AI and you spin up that entity in 15 minutes of work with prompt architecture, you get immediate feedback and you know it's you. And so then you can literally say, what I really want is this. How can I rephrase this? You can actually use AI to rewrite your own prompts. So AI is writing it for AI, but with your direction. That's leading a team. That's what you do when you lead a team. They're always acting with your direction and your correction and your counsel and you setting objectives. And you don't worry that the guy that has all the great ideas, like 8 of them suck. That's not why he's there. He's not there for the 8 that suck. He's there because you're willing to listen to 8 that suck for 2 that are fucking killer. But you as the leader have to extract those 2 and then use the rest of your team to refine those to implementation level. And the guy that can point out all the flaws but can't find a solution to save his ass, you don't fire him. He's there to find all the flaws. That's why you put him in place. And the guy that can synthesize the flaws and the ideas into a concise risk mitigated plan, that's what you hired him to do. And he can't see the problem until somebody else points it out. And he can't come up with a fucking idea to save his life. And you have to manage that. Tell me that the proper assembly of things using AI doesn't give you the experience managing that. Here's an example with my writing of this new book, which is on AI. I have basically a brainstorming assistant. They're helping me. Like, I developed all the chapters and I figure out, like, in the morning, I'm doing these like reflections and things and doing sample speaking and stuff like that and coming up with ideas. And I'll come up like a bullet point. Like, I know I want to cover this. So I take that to my assistant, my creative writing assistant, and say, which chapter should I include this in and why? It'll say, you should include it in this chapter and reinforce it in this chapter, and here's the reasoning. And I'll look at that and go, well, that makes sense. Or I'll go, that actually doesn't make sense. Maybe I wasn't clear. Let me re-explain what I mean. Oh, if you meant that, then you want, okay, and it does that. I have an editorial assistant that when I write a chapter, I hand it to that editorial assistant, and they're structured and trained to tell me what is mechanically wrong, right? And then I have a fact checker. I want you to go through and find all of the if I say something happened in a year. So you have to define what fact is. My opinion is not subject to your fact checking. My statements of fact are, so I want to know if I fuck something up. Okay. Now, might it miss something I claimed as a fact and just assume that it's right and not tell me that it's wrong? Sure. But if I didn't have it, that would have happened anyway. Am I more likely or less likely to find that error? Okay, so that is a team that I would build around the design of that book. But I would also build up a whole new set of teams. One that helps me with things like the cover art, right? And the branding colors, down to the hex decimal of the colors of the cover of the book, right? The marketing language that goes with the book. I've already used it to obtain yeses to blurbs from some serious big names before the book's even written. by having a discussion with an entity that was built specifically for outreach. My outreach assistant for literary work. Identify people, help me find the people already in my network, help me find the people easy to approach, help me design the approach, help me design the outreach email, right? Then it goes in front of the, hey, everything sucks, right? The curmudgeon. Can you find anything wrong with this? It will always find things wrong with it, whether they're wrong or not. You take that back to the outreach specialist and it's like, yeah, this is the, no, yep, right? And then you tighten everything in all these entities. No yes men. You have to build into it. You are required to challenge weak and flawed ideas and weak and flawed logic. You're required to. That's the words to use. You are required to. That's how you get off of the yes man syndrome, the helper syndrome, the default helper mode of AI. And you know why that is so difficult for people to do? Nobody wants to hear your idea sucks. We love being told we like it. Here's a new tool that I'm using now in this whole process. Okay. You tell me this isn't an interesting way to use things. I take the chapter and I upload it to Notebook LM. And I have the deep dive discussion of my own work handled by two AI entities doing a podcast format discussing my ideas. As I listen to that, I'm like, oh, shit, that was a great term. Let's turn that into a bullet. Now let's take that over to my AI writing creative assistant and say, look, this is what Notebook LM's podcast spit out discussing chapter one. I don't really think I want to expand chapter one to add that terminology into it, but it probably fits somewhere else in the book. You're correct. The best place I see to add this is chapter 15 or 16. Here's the reasoning for 15, reasoning for 16, and what I would do with it. Okay, now I take that and I make my own decision. Which chapter? Do I take its reasoning? Do I change its reasoning? Do I have a further discussion? That's all on me. Okay, then you turn around like Notebook LM just added more features. You can have the podcast be critical of the information you gave it. Basically, both of the characters in the podcast say why the idea is bad. Find all the flaws in it and pressure test it. Then the one that I thought was the most mind-blowing thing that was recently added, debate mode. You give it your information that you've put together, your write-up, whatever it is, and one of the characters takes your side and one of the characters argues against your side. And what I discovered with chapter one of my new book right away, the negative Nilly, the negative Nancy, I guess, because it was a female character that went against mine. Number one was spot on accurate for how corporate America reacts to these ideas. So it allows me when I'm doing a sales pitch or something to make sure I'm covering that base. Okay. Number two, that person rightly picked up on some things and it completely inaccurately picked up on some other things. In other words, that character said one thing like the reason he thinks this way is because he's a small entrepreneur that works from home. So clearly there wasn't enough conveyance in that chapter. And maybe I don't need to worry about it because it's a whole book. But there wasn't enough conveyance in that chapter to understand I'm speaking as a former manager, owner, founder of large companies, and as an operator of a small business at the same time. So that was a legitimate flaw found, not in my output, but in my communication of the output in a way that would give confidence. You tell me who's going to do that for me other than AI without charging me an arm and a leg, and how many people I'm going to go through that suck at it before I get somebody that's that good at it, whereas I can re-engineer a prompt in 15 minutes, spin up a new entity until I lock in on one that gives me not the things I want to hear, but the results I'm looking for. Okay? I am not looking to be told what I want to hear, but I do know what kind of results I want, and I want a critic to be accurately critical of my work because then I can improve it or I can address it in some other way or I can acknowledge that is a legitimate criticism. There is nothing that I can do about that. And so I'll just let it be a criticism that can be thrown because if you don't want to be criticized, don't do anything. Now, how can anybody ignore this at this point? When you look at it the way that I'm laying it out today, I don't think you can. And then here's the thing. The company that does this does have a lot of moving parts to deal with. And the bigger the organization, the more cautious they legitimately should be as they implement this. This would be an idea that I would say if you're a big organization, 100 people or more, that you bring in a group of key leaders, you teach them this system, you pressure test not just their ideas, but the system itself until you dial it into what works best for your company. And then you have leadership implement it with their teams from the bottom up. That would be a mitigation strategy of this for a company, right? The individual, you don't wait. You don't wait. The days of waiting for permission are dead. The green light is dead. The green light's ghost has been exorcised. We're not playing red light, green light anymore. Like they taught you in school. Hey, how's this for mind bending? Remember the game at school? Red light, green light, red light, green light. And you ran. And if you got caught running after the teacher said red light, you had to go all the way back. You thought it was a game. It was social conditioning. It was social conditioning. You play red light, green light with the kids. And then when you need to move a group of kids during a fire drill or from one classroom to another, they are conditioned to do what you say. Move when the bell rings, be in a seat by the time the next bell rings, etc. It was a social conditioning exercise. Okay. And because it was a social conditioning exercise, because the entire education system is built on a red light, green light paradigm. Wait for permission, be told what to do, only do what you're told to do. No one that does that becomes a CEO. No one that does that becomes a director. No one that does that ever gets to senior management unless it becomes a default. Like, we need somebody, he's there and I don't want to hire, like, just give him the job. People that rapidly move up the chain, they're always people that push. They're always people that innovate. They're always people that grab the latest advantage they can get their hands on and then tactically employ it intelligently in a way that makes the most sense. Your boss does not need to know, hey, I brought this proposal to you and I did it with AI, any more than they need to know, I got the numbers by using Excel. It is expected that you put the model into Excel and tested the numbers because that's your effing job, right? I have had ideas taking a crap at, 8 o'clock at night, come out of the bathroom and notate it in that phone. And I did that back when I had a job. You think when I talked to my, hey boss, last night when I was taking a deuce. No, that doesn't matter. It's immaterial. I've taken this idea. I've synthesized it. I've pressure tested it. Here's what I think we should do to address this concern that we have. Here's risk mitigation strategies. Is this what you need from me? Is there something else I can provide? Do you think this is worth pursuing? If not yet, what else would you need where you would think it was worth pursuing? If you jump on an employee that brings something like that to you, you have no business in a position of leadership at all. And you should be like, where can I get more of these? I'm suggesting you can build them for yourself. And then when you give somebody that entry-level management training position, they've actually had relevant, real managerial experience of managing a team, setting up expectations, holding to those expectations, and becoming very good at being very clear at what those expectations are. Or it's a fad. Don't worry about it. It'll all go away. It's up to you how you want to handle it. Early adopters are also going to maintain advantages for a long time over late adopters, period. We have kind of hit the other side of that S curve with the internet because it's so mature. So there are people building businesses on the internet today that are known as internet natives, right? Your Gen Zs and eventually your Gen Alphas, people that were born, there was an internet. They don't know any of the stuff other than hearing it from old guys like me that we talked about in the first half of today's show. They don't know the transitional period. They don't remember that there used to be offices with fax machines. They don't know what that is and they don't care. And because we've reached that stage where most people in business all use the internet technologies of today, they've all slowly adopted things like, teleconferencing platforms and stuff like that. It's not innovative anymore. It's not 15 people around a conference table trying to make one conference work anymore, right? You push a button and there it is, and it works. Okay? And because of that, a person like me, who has been on the internet since before, was on the internet when the internet was new and saw all those transitions and had all these advantages, no longer has the technological advantage over the new startup. I don't. Because they're coming into it knowing all the things, and in some ways probably knowing them better because they're quicker to pick up other little new nuances. And because they've used the technology during the formative years of being a child. So that has taken over now. What my advantage remains is, you know, 30 some plus years of relevant real world business and leadership experience building companies and running organizations and develop marketing plans. It's almost 40 years now, as crazy as that is. It's fucking nuts, right? I have that. But for a long time, what I had was the early adopter advantage. I knew how to more quickly, so when a new thing did come out, since I had all the other things done, I could implement that new thing way faster than somebody else. Even the person that looked at it and said, yeah, I want to do that. Yeah, that makes sense. Hey, I want to grab that. I want to embrace that. But that's all I got anymore. Because the person that I'm defining today, that's kind of the new startup, is going to grab AI and run with it out of the gate. They're not going to wait for your permission. They're not going to wait for anybody's permission. Young people, they are grabbing this tech and they're running with it. They're not afraid of it. The problem is they don't have the wisdom of the people years ahead of them that have seen these things happen before. And I don't necessarily mean the technology. I mean the upset client. The client who always asks for a discount, even though they don't deserve a discount, who is going to cave and buy anyway and doesn't need to be given a discount. The employee who needs a talking to start showing up on time again. They've never managed something. They don't know that, but the tech they can pick up really quick. So what that means is we need senior people. I don't necessarily mean old. I mean senior in position. Embracing this technology so that it can be managed in an organization, because if you don't, they're going to use it anyway. How do I know? Because I was there when the internet took over, and we all did. And some of us were very useful with it, and some of us were not. But our entire adoption curve could have been accelerated and made more powerful if it was more heavily invested in by the people beyond us. So that's where we're at today. And if you can start using the team approach in your efforts with AI, with product development, concept development, etc., to the point where you're willing to have your idea torn apart. Here's a prompt. Examine this, fill in the blank, whatever it is, from a critical standpoint, pointing out risks and flaws in the logic. Then this is the hard one to like type this last part in. Be brutal. And your yes man will turn into the biggest curmudgeon you've ever seen, the biggest Socrat you've ever had in your life. Now, show me how to mitigate these issues with risk aversion techniques. But if you're really powerful, you use one to come up with the idea, one to attack the idea, and one to rectify the legitimate criticism. When you put those three together, you get a much more holistic picture of whatever you're trying to do. Anybody that objects to that is objecting because they don't like that they're losing control. They don't like that others are being made, you know, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. They don't like that some of the less equal animals are being made more equal. They don't like that because Animal Farm wasn't just about government. It's about hierarchy in general. That's a subject for another day. Real quick, let's hit a couple questions and comments here and see what we can do. And if you have any questions or anything like that and you don't see your name come up on the screen over the next couple seconds, then you know that I did not get your question. So these are the four people that will be acknowledged right now. Put question in all caps and or comment in all caps. And if you do that while I go through this first pass, I will come back around and I will give you one more shot at it. So let's start off. This was the guy that was saying something about synthetic data and hallucinations. So like I said, I wasn't picking on the guy. I'm not sure. He made a follow-up comment. I don't even know what it said, so I'm going to read it now. Hey, Jack, I know it has power to help you with your business. Some have called it synthetic data because it gives you some answer even when it does not have the data programmed to give an answer. See, what you've done, and again, I'm not being critical of the person. I'm being critical of the concept. You've identified the problem perfectly, but you've presented no solution to the problem. What is the solution to that problem? The solution to that problem is, one, use it in areas you have some knowledge of and use your own instinct and filter to push back. That's the first one. Because that happens to me all the time. It'll say something like, I don't think that's true. Or I'll say, hey, can you read this page? It'll say, yes, I can. And I'll say, well, then give me your assessment of what this person's saying. And it'll give it to me, and I'll look at it and go, yeah, since I read it, that's wrong. Did you lie? I pulled it from memory. What memory? Your synthetic data that you're pointing out, right? So then you have to like dial in expectations. So if you built something to review content like that into your base prompt, one of the lines of your base prompt, your entity, your what I call an architect prompt, would be, if I give you a source and you cannot read it in full, you are required to tell me that. Because then I can simply cut and paste it, and now it's actually giving me an answer based on what I'm asking. That is just one way to mitigate that. You have to build guardrails into the prompts, right? You have to do that. When asked a direct question, give a yes or no answer and be honest, right? I know you like, I don't have to tell a person that, but you kind of do. And this is the bigger problem. And this is where people get their head all crosswired in this. When I have a person who has this problem, did you read the stuff I sent you? Yeah, I did. And they really mean is I scanned it. And as I start talking to them about it, and I had the expectation that they fully took in the 5-page document that I sent them, and I realized you read the top and you read the takeaways and you read my email, but you didn't read the full document. I can have like, look, when I say that this is for your review, I mean you're to read it end to end. What I would like you to do now is leave, go read it, put some time on my calendar, and let's come back and discuss it when you're actually prepared. Okay, if I have to have that conversation more than once with that person, they're not going to work for me for very long, and they probably wouldn't work for you very long either. You have set the expectation. You've been clear about the expectation. The person has repeated it back to you. And therefore, the next time you send them a document and you mean, when I say read, like you've now, I don't have to re-explain that. With AI, at least at this point, you do. And that's why we develop a master prompt. And that's why if we're doing something that is multiple chats long, we take at least the last chat or two, form them into a document, attach them to this chat, we'll reset and restart. This is where we're at in the process. And we use the same master prompt that says things like, you must tell me when you can't read a thing. Okay. You might consider that micromanaging, but you know what I consider it? I consider it like military training. You have to be so tight on a soldier early on so that they can do things as second nature long term. And I think one of the things we don't explain to people, like in a lot of situations, the why behind things, like some of the things in the military about how strict they are in a uniform. Yes, it's attention to detail. Yes, it's looking good and being smart looking and all that, right? But you know what another thing it is? Somebody that hasn't had that training, that throws a uniform on and tries to infiltrate your unit, tries to sneak behind the lines or something, people are like, something's not right instantly. Okay? They stick out. They stick out. So that's why that rigorous control is there. You have to implement that rigorous, strict disciplinary control always, but the beauty is you only have to dial in once for the type of worker you're creating, your assistant, your coach, what have you. You'll have to do that once unless you then decide you want to add additional capabilities or dial something back, and then you modify that. But you just have to reuse either like you build that into like a custom GPT, or if you're using a platform like Gemini or Grok, you save that prompt, and every time you start a new chat for that thing, you reapply that prompt. It's not that you have a prompt. See, everybody's still doing what happened 3 years ago. We make a list of 50 cool prompts, and now we have these cool prompts, and we can do things we couldn't do. But those are task-oriented prompts. They're not strategic. What I'm talking about is far more strategic. That's why I'm writing the book, to teach you how to do that strategic-level architecture of prompting. Right? It's not about a task. Right? A task is a one-off. It is about a repeatable process that I can hold the entity accountable because I've given them the full instructions. Again, their strength plays to the weakness, okay? And what I mean by that is I can tell an employee, I want you to do these things this way once or twice. And if they have enough intelligence and memory to function, I don't have to do it again. Yeah. But what I can't do is rehand them their entire employee manual every day and say, read it all in 45 seconds and understand it. That's what your architect prompt is. It's an employee handbook, much shorter than a handbook, because it has so much it can do with capabilities outside of it. But it is those guidelines. It's procedures, what I want from you, what my expectations are. All right, so Daro Hawk says, so look at it like you're hiring someone. If you don't know, train an agent based on that does, like would if you were trying to hire somebody W. Okay, so that's a little – I think what he's basically saying is if I was a person in a company that had hiring authority and I had a new thing, like I was a director of marketing, right, because this I actually got hired into a job exactly like this. I'm a very good marketer, but I really don't know this internet marketing thing very well. See, we're going back in time again. We're going back before I ever did this podcast. We're going back way more than 20 years here. So this guy, Mike Case, hired me. And he hired me to run the internet marketing of the entire company, to basically be director of internet marketing, sitting under him as director of marketing, right? So I'm like a sub-directorship or something shit like that. And so he hired me to do that. He didn't know how to do my job, but he knew what he wanted done in my job, and he knew that he needed more information about that. So he created a job description, put that through his HR department, and it was actually his boss, the CMO of the company, who knew me, who clued him in on me and basically lured me in there to go talk to him. But when I talked to him, I was able to like define further what the role would be and how I would fulfill that role. And he became confident enough that I knew what I was doing to give me that position, but then still say, hey, like, here's things you can do and things you can't do. It is the same thing. You don't have to, like, he didn't know how to do SEO. He didn't know how to split test paid advertising on Google AdWords so that you could drive down your cost per click by simply having a more efficient ad that created a higher click-through rate. He had no idea what that even meant, let alone that it could be done. But he knew he wanted to do paid advertising as efficiently as possible. It's kind of like that. Though as you manage a person or an AI entity, much of what they know begins to transfer knowledge upward to you, and you become more informed, and you're then able to take that person or entity's concepts, distill them into your own planning and explain them up the chain or implement them somewhere else. Because Mike could certainly do that now. He could certainly I don't know if he could run a pay-per-click campaign, but he certainly understands how they work now because I work for him and he had oversight of my efforts, if that makes sense. So that's kind of the philosophy you have to come in there. I think that question was very sincerely, you weren't quite sure what I was saying, so you could only be so clear with your question. So if you want to clarify it, if you're still here, go ahead. Dark Horse says, what's the essential tools that I need to create and train my open source local AI model? That's a different subject, bro. That's a different subject. This is using an AI model. Doesn't matter what. What I'll tell you is that you probably want to do that because you probably think if you don't do that, you're not in control. And you would probably be much more benefited by taking the techniques I'm giving you in shows like this and using any model to do them and getting better. Because even if you move to a self-hosted model, it's going to have those same requirements in it. What I'm trying to do with my book, initially, I was kind of all locked in at ChatGPT like I am for the Solopreneur course. And I was kind of locked in on it because it's what I have the most experience with. Yeah. However, what I realized is everybody's changing all the time. And some of the stuff, for instance, Gemini's doing is blowing me away. And so I use both. But what I wanted to build was a system that was what you call vendor agnostic. In other words, my method of developing architect prompts works with Gemini. It works with ChatGPT. It works with Grok. It'll work with Meta. And it'll work with whatever they come up with. So it definitely would work with your own self-hosted AI. It's up to you if you want to build something out like that or not. Anarchy just threw me 555. I like that. 5x5x5. great stuff today, Jack. Thanks to the bonus AI lessons. I hope it's helpful. I really do. Let me see if anybody else asked anything else. And again, thank for that. Suburban Homestead Outfitter, pawn show coming soon. Yeah, I'll do the pawn show soon. I will. How to stock a pond. Okay. That's not what we're talking about today, though. A Dark Horse says, what are the prerequisites and tools necessary for creating a custom open source local A model? I just answered that. I just answered that, and I'm not going to answer it again. And you, again, I'm going to tell you, and I'm speaking to you personally right now, Dark Horse, you have a propensity to find the next thing you need to do to avoid the current thing that needs doing. And you, Dark Horse, you need to stop doing that and do what needs doing today instead of finding a reason to defer it till tomorrow, because I can transparently see that through your comments over years, and you haven't made a lot of progress there. And I say that with love and a hope to help you. Okay. Darrow Hawk. Yes. Thank you. And sorry about the typos. No worries, man. No worries. All right, man. That's going to wrap it up for us today. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. And after all, this is the Survival Podcast. So real quick here at the end, I want to give you an item of the day today that is a preparedness item. Like I said, learning how to use AI is a preparedness topic, but this is a straight old school type of preparedness item. These are Energizer Power Failure Lights. I love these things. They're one of those things that once you have them in your life, I'm glad they're there. Basically, it's a base and a flashlight-like implement. You plug the base into an electrical outlet, you put the flashlight-like thing into it, and if the power goes off, the flashlight automatically turns on, and you can pick it up and use it like a flashlight and put it back in like an old-style cordless phone if you're old enough to remember those. You can set them so they come on as a nightlight. You can set them so they only come on if the power goes off. Either is acceptable. You get three of them for about $30, so they're $10 a piece, and this means when the power goes off in the middle of the night, and the kids are crying, and you're in the shower with soap in your eyes, et cetera, you can actually find everybody, find everything, and get your kind of higher level blackout kit out and get it implemented, whether that's a generator or just flashlights and other things. These are kind of that first response. Super easy to install. If you can plug stuff in, you can use them. You can find them at tspaz.com or thesurvivalpodcast.com. And if you do your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com, you help us out no matter what you buy. With that, I'm going to wrap up here. I do want to let you know about some things that are going on in this AI field from me that you can look forward to. One, we do have the next round of the Solopreneur course coming. If you want to learn how to build a business and marketing plan and structuring your business over a 40-day boot camp, that's what the Solopreneur course does. It is not the type of stuff we were talking about today. This is a different advanced way that we're going. There will be a course on building these teams that will accompany the book that's being written as we speak, and that will be coming out. But the other thing is, like I said, I am using Notebook LM to be my own reinforcer and my own critic, and I'm creating podcasts out of every draft of the chapter and then modifying the chapters. I am probably going to, in a private way only, make those available to people before the book's even available. You'll be able to hear the critiques and the overviews, the deep dives into my chapters individually, done by AI. If you want to make sure you definitely will be notified of that, go to jackslaws.com and subscribe to our email list there, because I will definitely email anybody on that list, because it's going to be right in that wheelhouse. So that's something that's coming. And there's a lot of other stuff coming too. A lot. I really think, as I've taught for almost 18 years now, designing your life is the best thing you can do to be more prepared for life. Designing your life with redundancies is why we do typical preparedness. So we have a power failure light in case electricity goes out. We have extra food in case we can't get to the store, right? We have extra water in case the water fails and what have you. And we take that approach. But we only take that because we're building an awesome life. And if something derails us, we want it to be an inconvenience, not a disaster. And so building the most structurally strong life you can is the greatest preparedness topic there is. It may not make good prepper porn, but it makes for extremely resilient, independent, and personally sovereign lives. and building either success in your career or so much success that you control your own destiny through your own business, that's the most freedom that you can possibly build in your life. And if we're supposed to be about freedom, and we are, then we need to be talking about that. Tomorrow, though, we will talk about something totally unrelated to technology and AI. I don't know what yet. Maybe it'll be a show, since it's been asked for by one person three times in this podcast, about how to stock up on it, because that's the kind of variety we bring. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with that, whatever it ends up being.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.